lights will come up a little bit more for you all. My Bible's open to 1 Kings 17. I'd like to encourage you to make your way there, and we'll get started in God's Word in just a moment. I would have you think on your way there, 1 Kings 17, to the last time you heard somebody give a speech. They stood and delivered something that was stunning. You maybe were in the audience, or you saw it on YouTube, or somehow you read it, or you know about a speech that was made, and immediately there was the sense in you that, wow, there's a backstory there somewhere. I'm not sure how that came about. I'm not sure how a human can put words like that together, but that was stunning to listen to. I have a dream is one of them. You maybe have heard of Martin Luther King because you're too young to have lived back in those days. But there was a man that said that, and everybody went, what? And it was a speech for the ages. I have a dream! And people paid attention and listened. And it set all kinds of things in motion. Ask not what your country can do for you. Said JFK once upon a time. It's a speech worth listening to. In fact, if you've gone to Arlington National Cemetery back east, you will see those words by his burial spot at the cemetery, etched in stone for all the ages, for generations to come. Because it was a speech that stopped you in your tracks. Mr. Gorbachev, take down that wall. I was alive then. I got chills. I got chills again. Every time I go back there and I think of that president who stood face to face with the darkest, at least embodiment of the day, the president of the prime minister of the Soviet Union, and said, we're not going to go away. Change it up. And people, the impossible, the unthinkable happened as a result of that speech. The wall they said would never come down came down. East and West were no longer divided. It was something that you had to check your pulse to remind yourself you're still actually living in this moment. It was that kind of crazy cool. I mean, it was as far-fetched as the Raiders winning a game. I mean, really, seriously. So when you hear a speech like that, you instinctively are curious about the backstory. Where did this greatness come from? How does that man or woman have that kind of oratory skill that causes people to go, what? If you want to give a label to this first verse of 1 Kings 17, you have to at least concede that this Elijah, we know nothing about. He came up from obscurity. And he shows up, and he's about to go toe-to-toe with the malevolent king of the ages. What I mean by that is he wasn't just a bad guy. He was as bad as it gets. In fact, most people's badness is measured against him. Well, you're bad, but you're not that bad, people would say. You're evil, but let me tell you about evil. His name's Ahab. And you would be right to call him evil. When Jezebel shows up, it just made him darker and darker. It's not a long speech. 27 words I counted. That's it. But 27 words that have made generations of Bible readers, Christ followers, go, what? Did you see that? People thought to themselves, you see those knees knocking? I could never do that. People wondered, where did this man, what's his name again? Elijah? Where did he get the moxie to go toe-to-toe with, let me just say it, the son of the devil? Ahab. Last week, we considered the question, and we came up with a few answers. They're all in verse 1. The first is this: Elijah was convinced that God existed. All right, that's why he says, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives." I am absolutely convinced, but there's more. You can be convinced that there is a God. You can be here right now, this morning, convinced there is a God. A lot of people will give you that on a MAX train. You believe there's a God? Oh, sure, sure. But it absolutely has done nothing to change their lives, because you can objectively say there's a God, but you can stay far from that God. In other words, he is God. There is a God, but he's not my God. I've never had him come into my life. Some of you that know your Bible know that I'm talking about a scene out of James chapter 2. He was the half-brother of Jesus, who said, you know something? Look, just to be straight, the demons had it clear. They had it straight about who this God was. Demons do. And in fact, he adds, they had their facts straight about God, and that is that he exists, and it made them shudder. It made them nervous. That's as far as it went. They didn't submit to him and will be separated from him in hell for all of eternity. This is close to a Bible-thumping moment I'll ever have. But it's true. So it's possible to have facts straight. If there is a God, he lives, and spend eternity separated from that God because he doesn't live in you. There's the action point for some of you today. Don't make the mistake of the demons. Make him your God. Now that's one of the explanations for why Elijah could say these things in verse 1. Here's the second one. He not only was convinced that God existed and that he existed in his life, he was convinced that he was a personal representative of the living God. Remember what he says next: "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve." Take notes. Make sure you got it clear. I align myself with that God. I serve him, and that makes me a personal representative of him. And I'm on assignment for him. By the way, you know what I'm going to say next. So are we. If he lives inside of you, he's got an assignment for your life. Which led thirdly to this potential explanation for how could a guy say these things to Ahab and live to tell about it. He was clear that his strength was in the Lord, not in himself. Elijah was clear that his strength was in the Lord and not in himself. His resources came from the God who never sleeps or slumbers and has absolutely no need. Elijah was clear about that. If Elijah were here this morning and we asked him a couple of questions, I thought about this. I actually thought maybe I could get somebody to dress up like him and walk in. Not sure what he looks like, but he's probably as tall as Mitch Brennan. But so he walks in, right? And if we asked him, hey, you know, Elijah, do you go by Elijah or just Jeh or something, you know? And we say, you know, we're kind of curious about this. You know, I'm curious what it's like to do what you did. Now, I think his answer would surprise us. That's my first kind of thought when I was imagining this. I bet he would say, well, listen, it's not in the text, but I was shaking in my sandals when I went up there. A little bit like Moses, remember? You want me to go to who? And say what? And Moses tried repeatedly, four or five times, to get out of it. And God said, no, I got you. You're the guy. I want you to go. His name's Pharaoh. And he did. And he led his people to freedom. So I think he would have started with My knees were knocking. I was shaking in my sandals. But I think then he would have probably said, here's something deeper. God was doing something deep inside my life. And I think he might have even said, I want to tell you a couple of things that he taught me when he took me away and had me hide. That's what I want us to ponder this morning. On the heels of this 27-word speech in verse 1, where he announces God's judgment of drought on the evil king, we read these words, verse 2. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kereth Ravine, east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have directed the ravens to supply you with food there. So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kereth Ravine, east of the Jordan, and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Sometime later, the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Now, I'll stop for a moment and let you digest this thought. You don't have to look real hard. Doesn't take much thought to connect these dots. The Elijah who is in the public, verse 1, with the Elijah who's in the private, verses 2 to 7 or 8. And there's an intended connection going on here. It's this principle, and I'll give you time to reach for a pen because it is absolutely important that you get this principle down. Not just to get this lesson down. It's way bigger than that. You got to get this principle down to make sense out of some of the weird ways, my words, that God works in us when we're hiding, when we've actually been sent into hiding. So here's the principle. If God is going to work through you, you must let God work in you. Now, I would say, let's show of hands. How many want God at some point, in some way, at some level, to work through you? That's pretty good, about 80%. Well, if you raised your hand first time, then you must raise your hand next time, hopefully by the end of this message. If you want that to happen, for God to work through you, you must let him work in you. Now, God did big, bold things in a nation that had lost its spiritual mind through a prophet who spent time with God alone. Most of us, I think, who want to make a difference for God, recognize at the same time there are so few people stepping up to do something that it makes us sort of, well, put the accelerator down even further. We see so much that needs to happen. And so, you show me a need, make an announcement here, and almost every single time, the people that already have two plates overflowing of stuff that they're doing are stepping up saying, I can't let that need go unmet. I got to do something. Instead of what Jesus would want, and that is for some that are content to sit back and wait and watch, going, no, it's my turn. So if you're being used by God, the tendency is when you hear a need, you step up and accelerate even further. Yet you hear God say, ho, I have plans for you right now. I want you to go away. I want you to hide. And I want you to be alone. And don't move until I tell you what I want you to do next. By the way, that's the pattern in the Gospels. When Jesus sent out his disciples, I hope you'll write this down, Mark chapter 6, and you'll do your own study later today. But in Mark chapter 6, you have this wonderful scene where Jesus has already selected his disciples, and he's trained them, and then he says, hey, guys, circle up. It's kind of like a huddle in football, only there's 12, not 11. All right? And they gather up, and he's the QB in the huddle, and he says, here's the deal. I'm going to send you out. I'm not going to take you out. I'm going to send you out. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go and touch people's lives. I want you to go and tell people about me. I want you to go and be used by me. Ready? Break. And they took off, and by twos they went in various directions. This is all Mark chapter 6, starting at verse 7. And they go away, and they're touching lives, and they're teaching, and they're healing people. They're seeing God actually heal people. And all this is going on, and then they come back. And we're told that when they came back, it's like in verse 30 or so, they come back and they report all that they had seen and done. Now, you got to know this. It's not in the text, but picture me right now. This is the disciples when they came back. This is them going, and it's not because they had to go potty, okay? They were pumped. They had seen God do something great. And surprise of surprise, God used them. They came back and they said, wow, check this out. We saw this happen. And they go on and on and on. And then something really candidly out of place happens next. The very first words you hear from Jesus as he's watching these disciples go, oh, my turn. Let me tell you what happened over here. And over. Jesus says, here's the deal, guys. Come away with me by yourselves and get some rest. You know what? I've just read the verse 31, Mark 6. I've just read words that are nearly impossible for more than a few of us. It's exactly what God tells Elijah and Jesus tells his disciples to do. Go away and hide. Must represent something vital to the plan God has for us, or he wouldn't have for us the assignment to go, as he told Elijah, and hide. So, for a few moments left, let's probe a question. What did God work in Elijah's life while he hid? Fair enough? I see two things. The first, write this down, unflinching obedience. What did God work in Elijah? An absolute, unquestioned obedience. Let's go back to the text because the sequence is very significant. You got to see this. God initiates by giving a command. Verse 2. The word of the Lord came to Elijah, leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kerith Ravine east of the Jordan. That's the clear instructions that God gives him. Call it a command because that's exactly what he gave him. So what I want you to do, go away to a brook, we'll get there in a minute, and I want you to hide. So that's the command. And with the command comes a promise of provision by God. Verse 4, you will drink from the brook, and I have directed the ravens to supply you with food there. It bears repeating that God never commands that you and I do something or stop doing something without providing a way. You with me on that? You cannot find something in this book, his Bible, where he expects you to do something or stop doing something and not at the same time find a provision. That would be setting you or me up for failure, wouldn't it? Let's take temptation. How many have temptations? Raise your hand. Okay. So if we took a poll, what's God's expectation for you when it comes to whatever had you holding your hand up? What's God expect you to do with that temptation? Pray, okay. Give into it. You're just human anyway. Tie this string of verses together. Romans 13, 14 says, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regards to its lust. 2 Timothy 2, verse 22, that was Romans 13, 14. 2 Timothy 2, verse 22 says, flee youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call upon the Lord from a pure heart. And then 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, most of us know these words somewhere in our memory. There's no temptation that has overtaken you that isn't common to men or women. In other words, you're not alone. This isn't bigger than you, and it's not uncommon. Other people have experienced this too. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with that temptation will provide a way of escape so that you can do what he expects you to do when you face temptation. Escape it. Not give in to it. God's expectation is that we overcome temptation. That's his command. To ensure our success, God provides a way of escape. That's the really great news. Just like with Elijah, when God conveys a command, he provides a means of pulling it off. Now, back to the text. What Elijah did next is incredibly revealing. The command, I want you to go east. The provision, I'll take care of your food and there's water there. What he does next in verse 5 is really revealing. So he did what the Lord had told him. That's revealing? You bet it is. He was told what to do. The promise was made for him when he did that. And he did what was expected of him. Three words for it. He obeyed God. And let's be fair to Elijah. It wasn't just a grease slide. This wasn't just easy to do. If you were to ask him, what did it feel like in verse 1? How did it feel, man? You're right in it. Right in the middle of it. And he probably have said, I'm ready to keep going. Keep pressing this campaign. Get this thing finished. So he could have got stuck here and said, wait a second, God. Good things just happened. And you're telling me to leave that and go hide? By the way, I think we made note of this along the way. Elijah is a Jew. And Jews have a problem with ravens. Did you know that? A raven is a dirty bird. That's not a surprise to anybody here. I'm not the only guy that tries to chase them down in my car and take out those black, worthless bird. It is. It's a dirty bird. And I'm sorry to you animal people, but really, you can't even shoot them and get the bullet to go into them. It just bounces off their stupid wings. It's a rotten bird. It's nasty. Okay, so enough. So my point is, you know what Elijah could have done at that? You're feeding me how? Not what. How? God, let me help you with this a little bit. You're asking a dirty bird, the word that Jews use, unclean. Okay? You're asking an unclean fowl, they're fowl in both senses of the word. You're asking that bird to get food in its mouth and deliver it, fly it in to this brook. God, that's not good. It's not clean either. But he didn't get stuck there, did he? Because Elijah was learning the critical importance, the critically important role that obedience plays for anyone who wants to please God. You got all your reasons why it won't work, why it's not convenient. By the way, Elijah's not alone. Ask, go as far back as you want. Abraham, Moses, David, Rahab, the harlot, New Testament, Mary, mother of Jesus, John the Baptist, Jesus himself. And they will tell you again and again the critical role obedience plays. And God was growing that in Elijah here. There's a second thing that is even bigger than that. God was growing in Elijah this unshakable obedience, this relentless obedience. I will obey you. Secondly, he was shaping in him an unshakable faith. Will you write that down? That's the second thing going on here. God developed in Elijah an unshakable faith. The prophet is told to travel from Samaria, where he confronted Ahab in verse 1, a marathon's distance east. It's 26 miles. As the blue jay flies, not the crow. He's told to travel 26 miles to a brook, a small creek, a river, to be alone. His only provision and protection would come from God. Don't forget, God made the promise of provision back in verse 4. You're going to drink from this brook. There is water. Remember, it started in verse 1. The rains stopped that day. There's no other source of water. So God's going to provide for him. And Elijah took action to believe that God would make good on his promise. That's verse 5. He did what the Lord had told him. So he arrives at this brook, right? He did what the Lord said. He went to this Kerith ravine east of the Jordan, and he stayed there. So I want you to picture what he's doing. He's arrived at this brook, and like any river we can think of, take the Deschutes out near Bend in that area. It's pretty dry not far from the river itself, right? Sagebrush, rattlesnake country. I mean, it's real dry. But near the river itself, what's it look like there? Gets green, right? And if there's grass, it's lush. And I don't know if you've listened to a river. One of the things Debbie and I like to do is just drive up near rivers and just sit by them and listen. So he had all that going on. He has this beautiful brook, this, we could call it a pastoral setting. It's picture postcard perfect. And he's kicking back by this, in this setting, and enjoying what God is providing. Let me just say it, it might be an exaggeration. He's living the dream. Well, I just had a showdown with Ahab. God sends me to this place, and even though it's not raining, I got a river running by me. It's peaceful. It's a great place to be. Oh, I've got more than a river. I've got food coming my way every day. It's all right here for me. Living the dream. And not surprisingly, isn't that how it's supposed to be? Isn't that how it's supposed to work? You live for God. You follow his word. You obey him. And life goes well, right? Some of you are wisely looking at me like, I've got an exception to that I could tell you about. Or a handful of them. Obey God and all goes well with you. Now that would be true if it weren't for the fact that God wants to do work in you that can't be done quickly or easily and almost never happens without pain and without God bringing about need in your life. That's why verse 7 is so shocking. Look at verse 7 and let's read it. Sometime later, the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. We're not told ever how long sometime later is. We do know that it didn't rain for 3.5 years from verse 1 of this chapter into chapter 18 when the rains came and the drought was broken. We know that was 3.5 years. We're just not told because from here, we'll see next week, he takes off. God sends him now to the north, wouldn't you know, to where Jezebel, the evil queen, came from. More on that next week. But somewhere in this time Elijah spent at the brook, life was okay. Yet somewhere between verse 7 we just read and verse 8, the test became intense. You see, the brook dried up, verse 7, before the word of the Lord came to him, verse 8. That's not just a casual observation. That is deep theology. The brook dried up before God made clear to him his next move. This is where and when his faith was being tested and toughened. The same happens for us. Isn't that what James was talking about? Consider it pure joy, brothers, verse 2 of chapter 1. Consider it pure joy, brothers, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith is producing endurance. And let endurance have its way. In other words, don't interrupt what God is doing with this trial. Let endurance have its way so that you might have something you couldn't have any other way. You might be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing. James 1, 2 to 4. Elijah's living that out right here. I have a question for you this morning. Have you ever prayed for more faith? I'm pretty sure that the path to that outcome, if you actually have more faith today than before you prayed for it, I'm pretty sure that the path to that outcome was anything but smooth. God, I want more faith. It's a dangerous prayer. Would you agree? Scary stuff. Be careful what you pray for. Right? Some of us here at Grace Point, we like this prayer. Lord, make me more like you and less like me. I almost never recommend that to somebody without telling him, you got to know what you're getting into here. Okay? Because sometimes God uses a chisel, a chainsaw, blasting caps, something to get some of you out of the way so some of him can get in there. It's just a reality. Lord, make me more like you and less like me. And then when the drought comes and the brook dries up, we cry out, God, what are you doing here? What are you up to? I wanted you to make me more like you and less like me. And if we'll quiet down, we may actually hear him say, I'm answering your prayer. That's what I'm up to. That's what I'm doing. I'm very fond of an anonymous poem that kind of describes some of my journey with God. It's entitled, And God Said No. I think you're going to like it. I asked God to take away my pride. Is that a fair enough prayer? God's opposed to the proud, gives grace to the humble, James 4, 6. Okay, so I asked God to take away my pride. And God said no. He said it was not for him to take away, but for me to give up. I asked God to grant me patience. Anybody else pray for patience this morning? Okay, not Sunday. Yesterday, Saturday traffic. Golly, Costco lines, are you kidding me? So I asked God to grant me patience. And God said no. He says patience is a byproduct of tribulation. It isn't granted, it's earned. I asked God to give me happiness. What's wrong with that? And God said, no. He said he gives blessings. Happiness is up to me. I asked God to spare me pain, and God said, once again, no. He said, I must grow on my own, but he will prune me to make me more fruitful. Besides, suffering draws me apart from the cares of this world and brings me closer to him. Let's agree that those kind of virtues, patience, happiness, growth, those are good things. They're worth pursuing. I think we'd all agree. But the pathway God uses to cultivate them is the stuff of tribulation and trouble and trials. Just ask Elijah, surprisingly like us. I suspect this morning that Elijah, his story is talking to us in very contemporary ways in our own situation. I suspect he wasn't the first, nor will he be the last person to sit by a brook of blessing and watch it dry up. So this morning, what's the drying brook in your life? What does that look like? When it dried up, did you find yourself wondering, what's up, God? Has something happened that I should know about? Trying to walk the straight path, have I taken a wrong turn? Have I found my way off road accidentally or intentionally? What's this about? I think if you looked and looked and looked, you would not find some sin reason for why the brook dried up for Elijah. It's not there. I've checked. It's just not there. It was the curriculum that God was using to perfect the prophet and prepare him for much greater impact that we will read together in coming weeks. It's possible the same is true for you this morning. God is working the stuff of obedience and faith in you today so he can maximize the use he gets through you tomorrow. Will you let him? I'd like you to bow your heads as we prepare to spend some time personally with him. Let me begin again with that question I just left off with. You know, you might be by a brook and it's not dried up yet, but you see it's not flowing anymore. That brook of blessing is now just puddles along the way. There's no sign of rain to make it flow again. It's not in the forecast either. You just know you're in a spot. And you've got a choice to make. You really do. Right now, you have a choice to make. With that choice, are you going to resent that the brook's drying up? This ticks me off, God. How did I deserve this in a Job-like way? You can say that and probably not get the point. But today you got a choice to stop resisting and resenting the drying brook in your life. Are you going to choose that? Will you say, you know, Lord, make me useful to you, whatever that may involve? I'm going to invite you in a moment to take communion at the stations that have been set up. And when you do, it'll be like other times of communion, but there's a different voice I want you to hear today. I want you to go to that table, and I want you to listen carefully. And see if you don't hear Jesus saying, not my will, but thine be done. And if you'll listen long enough, maybe you'll hear him say, I meant that for you too. Let's respond to him now.